Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so in this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I talk about things that work for me, but also those big epic fails that I've made along the way, like what I'm going to talk about today. And all because I believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. So on this podcast, I talk about student-centered learning. I talk about what it means in a world of AI. I talk about project-based learning. And again, it's because I really believe we need to prepare students for this uncertain world. And before we get started with today's topic, I just want to say, if you do not follow me already, check out my website. It is spencereducation.com. And also that is the same like a name or whatever for my Instagram. So you can find me on Instagram at Spencer Education. And you can also find me on Facebook again at Spencer Education. So please check those things out. And then if you go to spencervideos.com, it will take you to my YouTube channel. And I would love for you to follow me there on YouTube. And finally, if you don't subscribe to my newsletter, I send a weekly newsletter out with my blog posts and my podcast, just a fun little reminder. But I also like to share little free resources that you can get that are only available to people who subscribe to my newsletter. So check it out as well. Without further ado, let's dive right into this idea of the mistakes I made in Genius Hour and what I learned as a result, how I fixed it. So I'm going to start with, surprise, a story, my Genius Hour disaster. So picture this. I'm standing at the center of the classroom, surrounded by a giant circle of students staring back at me. The room is silent aside from the hum of old desktops that we recently refurbished using Linux. There's a buzz of excitement after we just completed a service learning project and a documentary. My kids are ready to go. The year is, by the way, 2006. At this moment, I do that very normal teachery thing of waiting till everyone is absolutely silent. And then I wait a little more just for dramatic effect. And then I say, "What do you think we'll do next?" A hand shoots up. "A podcast?" a boy asks. I shake my head. "No way. It's not a podcast." A girl raises her hand and asks, "A museum project where we design the exhibits?" I shake my head again. But then I say, "You're both right." The students are looking around in confusion. I can hear the waves of whisper spread around the room. "What do I mean by you're both right?" I then look around and say, "Let me explain." I ask the students to gather at the front of the room where I turn on the projector and press play on my computer. We watch a 3-minute video explaining Google's concept of 20% time, where each employee has a single day per week to do a passion project where they pursue their own interests. This is essentially the notion of Genius Hour, which was actually first developed in the 1960s by 3M, and it was not 20% time, it was 15% time. But it's the idea that students can pursue their own interests and passions and topics according to whatever they are interested in. At this point, I ask my students to return to their seats. And then I continue. "I want you to think big. What do you want to learn at school if you could learn anything at all? If you could pursue one topic, what would it be? If you could learn one new skill, what would you learn? If you could make something new, what would you make? I want you to brainstorm a list of at least 5 different things you would do in a passion project." I wander the room as students scribble out their ideas. I see topics ranging from skateboarding to fashion to learning ASL. One student asks me, "Does it have to be something new? What if I'm already an expert, but I want to spend more time learning about it? I nod. It sounds perfect to me. It's your own passion project. Go as deep with it as you want. Students then do a stand-up hair-up pair-up. Sorry, a stand-up hand-up pair-up. Did I say that? I think I did. Okay. It's a Kagan structure where they share their ideas with one another. I then explain the basic parameters of the project. Each student has to do research. They can come up with a new skill, a new product, a new topic, whatever they want. And then at the end, they will share what they learned at our community celebration at the end of the semester. Within seconds, students leap into action with this collective frenzy, and they start sketching out on sticky notes. And I listen to the chaotic conversations filled with moonshot dreams of what they might create. The same thing occurs with each additional class period. This is going to be epic. Little do I realize that this will actually be an epic fail. Fast forward a week and the excitement begins to wane. I forgot my topic, a student tells me. I don't know where to get started, another student says. Can you tell me if I'm on the right track? One boy asks. I pull the class back together and I remind them of the core idea, but instead of excitement, I notice a collective sense of dread. Students are overwhelmed. It's okay if you make mistakes, take risks, be bold, I implore them. It doesn't help. Students are completely overwhelmed. The next week is even worse. Students wander around, sharing playground gossip and talking about fantasy football picks. They chat about their favorite songs and TV shows. And while on some level, yeah, they're pursuing their own interests, I'm unable to tell what exactly they're actually learning right now. Three students pull out their math homework and they treat the class period as basically a study hall. And I quietly abandon this experiment with no explanation to anyone. Only once does a student even ask me, whatever happened to the passion projects? The short answer? The passion fizzled. And I learned that passion alone cannot fuel an independent project. I wanted my students to go for moonshot ideas. But here's the thing about a moonshot. It takes a ton of planning and focus if you actually want to reach the moon. And I hadn't taught my students how to plan, and I had not given them any sense of focus. It was just one of the many reasons why this project failed so miserably. I think it's important right now to mention that one of my favorite elements of teaching is when we give a chance or get a chance to share our mistakes. And that's what I'm doing right now. I want to share the mistakes I made and what I learned. I'm going to take a quick detour from this to talk about my favorite TV shows regarding cooking. Just stick with me or fast forward 2 or 3 minutes. It's up to you. I love watching the TV show Chopped. And there's a lot of other ones like this, but I love Chopped on the Food Network. The intense competition, the time pressure, the creative constraint of using limited ingredients. For what it's worth, I love how a show called, I would love to have a show called Chopped Home Edition. And my idea is the contestants have a limited time and resources, just like regular Chopped, but they also have to make something that three teenagers will love. And during this, one of the teenagers asks about homework, another one wants to debrief her day at school. And meanwhile, two Great Danes attempt to countersurf, and you have to keep them away, but not outside of the kitchen. That would be my life. So that's Chopped. It's super tight, it's super competitive, and it's high stakes. But then there's this other show, and it's sort of the opposite of Chopped. It's called America's Test Kitchen. And this is where they take a mediocre recipe and they test it with multiple variables until they achieve greatness. They move methodically and collaboratively. They combine best practices with innovative strategies. While a mistake on Chopped might send a contestant home, a mistake on America's Test Kitchen is simply another experiment, and one that maybe didn't turn out the way they wanted, but ultimately led them toward better success. So I'd like to do a little America's Test Kitchen right now and share my mistakes with Genius Hour, but then what I did over slow iterations throughout an entire decade of doing Genius Hour projects and how I changed things along the way. I believe to my core that teaching is an iterative process. And over time, things improve. It's not a quick improvement model. There's no way to hack it. So I'm going to share my screw-ups, my epic fails, and then what I did to fix it. So issue number one is this, or mistake number one, you could say. I didn't provide enough structure. Initially, I assumed that students would be self-directed and simply get to work alone on their passion projects. But instead, I had kids treat it as a study hall where the hardest students were working on other class work and other kids were just socializing. The classroom became chaotic and noisy, and I ended up saying things like, get to work and come on, guys. You don't want to lose out on these projects, do you? And honestly, I just became a total nag. At first, I thought the issue was accountability. And to a certain extent, it was. In future iterations, I would require students to turn in elements of their Genius Hour projects for review. However, I noticed that when the students were highly motivated, they were still failing to get started on their work. And as I walked around the room, I noticed that students weren't bored. They were overwhelmed. The main culprit turns out to be something called cognitive overload. Now, I've talked about this in the past, but I want you to imagine a 10-pound dumbbell above your head. For a lot of people, that's pretty easy, right? But if you're holding it for 20 seconds, it starts to become a bit much. Hold it for 2 minutes, and it's challenging, but not impossible. Your arm might start shaking. You might start feeling weak. Your muscles burn. But now hold it for 15 minutes or an hour. And by the way, please do not do this. This is not a workout podcast. I promise you, like, this is only an analogy. Please do not do this. Over time, even a small amount of weight can grow unbearable. Your muscles can only handle the weight for so long before they need rest and recovery. Now, in a similar way, our brain can only handle a certain amount of information before we hit what John Sweller refers to as cognitive overload. CLT, cognitive overload, explains how the human brain processes and stores new information, and it recognizes that we can only do so much in what is called our working memory. So Sweller talks about three different types of cognitive load. Two of them tend to be really good, one of them not so much. So intrinsic load, this is the inherent difficulty of the material. We want students to lift some difficult material. We need some intrinsically challenging load, right? But then we have extraneous cognitive load. And this is the distractions, unnecessary information, anything that is not aiding in the learning process, irrelevant details, cluttered visuals, that kind of stuff. And then there's germane load. This is the mental effort used to truly understand the material. This is what's going to allow you to master the concepts or the skills at hand. Now, why does this matter? Looking back on this, my students were experiencing tons of extraneous load. They didn't know where to go, where to start, what to do. They didn't have a chance to move into any kind of intrinsic load or germane load because all of their attention, it was focused on, what am I supposed to do? What's being asked of me? It was too much. They were hitting cognitive overload. And that was a very real problem. So how did I fix it? In my second iteration of Genius Hour, or at the time I called them passion projects, I began providing specific structures and protocols that would reduce cognitive load. I incorporated design thinking And that allowed us to break the project into phases. I also had some soft accountability where I could track whether students were ahead or behind on their projects. And then in future iterations, I not only used protocols and structures, but I began providing planning documents that served as like a loose template or a guide for their work. I incorporated self-reflection surveys to improve metacognition. And finally, on another iteration, I actually moved to a place where I taught students how to engage in self-management through project management, where I gave them these protocols, these structures that they could use to manage their own projects. And that turned out to be really effective at reducing the cognitive load. Okay, issue number two, students didn't know what to do because I hadn't provided examples. So imagine telling someone about football, but never showing them an example of a game. And so you're saying something like this. So the center is at the line of scrimmage and he snaps the ball to the quarterback who may or may not be in a shotgun formation. If it's a wildcat or read option offense, there might be a halfback or fullback on each side. It would be totally confusing if you'd never actually seen a game of football. And this is essentially what I did with these passion projects. I talked about Google and I shared the concept of doing it, but my students didn't know what it looked like. They hadn't seen a passion project in action. So initially what I did is I actually overcorrected and I gave them this very restrictive formulaic project handout. It's probably my third iteration of Genius Hour that I did this. It was way too much. And then later I began modeling the Genius Hour concept by sharing my own journey. I would tell them what was working, what was not working. And I found that this helped a lot. I would show examples that range from multiple topics and approaches. And what I realized is that the goal was not to provide a blueprint. It was to provide a roadmap and then let them determine their journey. The other thing that I did is I just gave a lot of exemplars from multiple domains. So when we were doing the Geek Out blogs, here's blogging from fashion blogs to foodie blogs to whatever. When we're doing how-to videos, we looked at some YouTube videos connected to it. And the goal was to just get them to see what was out there. And my fear was if I give them examples, they're just going to cheat or they're just going to copy. It won't be very creative. But what I found is actually that when you give exemplars from multiple domains that really range in production value and in topic and in approach, it helps students see what is expected of them without necessarily being something that they need to copy. And they actually engage in more creative risk-taking and ultimately design something more creative. All right, how about issue number three? I didn't consider alternative grouping. I remember the first time a group of people came to me and they wanted to work together and I said, nope, this is an individual project. I'd really rather you work independently. And what I did is I crushed the opportunity for students to work collaboratively and interdependently. I was worried that they would just copy off of each other. I was worried that they would do a smaller amount of work. That was my big fear. And so how did I fix this? It was a simple fix. I just told students that they could work with other students. It might mean working permanently in a small group on a project altogether, but it might also involve joining another group briefly to add your own opinions and skills and expertise. And I was nervous as groups of friends started to converge, but actually the best projects were ones where students worked with close friends where they had a shared knowledge on a particular topic. I think there's the power in the trust and vulnerability of friendships. There's challenges connected to it, but it's not always a bad thing. We often think about letting students work with friends as if it's automatically this bad thing, and I just didn't find that to be true. But I also found ways to vary the grouping within the project itself. So if students chose a small group project, I asked for moments of silence where students would work independently on their share of the project. If students worked on an individual Genius Hour project by themselves, they would share their insights using a think, pair, share, time, pair, share. We incorporated those cooperative learning strategies into the entire process. We also use things like peer feedback, doing the 20-minute peer feedback process. So the goal was no one working on an individual version is going to actually work by themselves the whole time. They are going to collaborate, even though it is sort of individual forward or centered on the individual autonomy. Similarly, though, if you're working in a small group, you're still going to have individual accountability. You're still going to work on elements of this by yourself. So making sure that there's multiple grouping mechanisms within the project. Issue number four, I didn't set clear behavioral expectations. I remember hearing people talk about the virtues of noisy, messy environments. And so I thought, you know what, this just has to be messy. It has to be noisy. But the truth is, I thrive in spaces that feel safer and even quieter. I prefer a gentle hum to a loud cacophony. I actually get physically anxious when a class feels out of control. And that's true when I go and visit classrooms. It's not just a thing about me being in charge. I have sensory issues on top of it. That plays into it. But I also want students to feel the freedom to like to be themselves. And sometimes that involves being, a little bit loud. So in the future iterations, I began setting expectations on the procedures. For example, students could move from group to group, but they couldn't run, right? We had some sharp objects. They could work standing up or sitting down, but they had to be sitting down and listening in the rare moments where I was talking to them during direct instruction. They could talk to other group members, but they couldn't shout across the room, right? So we had these rules and procedures. And what I found was this sense of order didn't take away from their creativity. It didn't take away from their autonomy. It just allowed things to run more smoothly. So I would say be very cognizant of classroom management issues. Issue number five, I didn't allow students to own the academic side of it. Initially, I tracked academic progress. I connected their Genius Hour projects to academic standards. I even wrote out individual learning targets. But in the end, I graded their projects on a common rubric with broad topics like creativity and critical thinking. And it was exhausting to design these specific lesson plans for each student. So here's what I did. I shifted it to be focused on the academic element and then designing the projects to fit key academic standards. These were often multidisciplinary, but just kind of hear me out on this. The first version that I did that was different was to shift from Genius Hour, really big, to Geek Out Blogs, where students got to choose the topic, but they were required to do expository, persuasive, how-to, narrative style. And because all of the standards in ELA are topic neutral, they could pick whatever standards they want. So then I eventually added parameters related to social studies, including a timeline of the topic, an exploration of a primary source. You get the idea. We did another one where they learned a new skill and they had to document what they were learning. So it could be learning a new language, learning a new instrument. But I tied that to these informational text standards that they were learning in language arts as well. We did entrepreneur projects where they got to do a personal passion and pitch it into a business. But with this one, the academic element was focused on social studies standards in economics along with ELA standards. And on this academic element, I also incorporated things like front-loaded vocabulary, direct instruction, academic tutorials to help students master the academic standards while they were also pursuing their interests. And over time, I gave students more and more ownership of these academic elements of the Genius Hour project. We did one-on-one conferences, self-reflection surveys, all kinds of stuff like that. And the goal was to get them to own this process. They engaged in peer assessment, self-assessment, and I wanted them to see that the ownership wasn't just of the topics or the project, but I wanted to build metacognition. So they were thinking about thinking. They were understanding what they knew, what they didn't know, and what they needed to do next. The last issue, and I've kind of alluded to it a bit with the previous ones, especially the first idea of cognitive overload. But this next one is, I didn't understand the danger of choice paralysis. Initially, when students said things like, I don't know where to start, I assumed they were just being too compliant. If I could get them to see that they truly had the permission to make their own decisions, they would thrive. And so I said things like, make glorious mistakes, try something big. I would rather see you strike out swinging than strike out on a called third strike, which a lot of my students didn't follow baseball, so it went completely over their head. And yet, despite the pep talk, students still seemed overwhelmed. So what was going on? Why would students reject voice and choice? If it wasn't compliance, and it wasn't even fear, what was going on? The issue was choice paralysis. So there's this classic behavioral economics book called Paradox of Choice. And in it, Barry Schwartz describes how overwhelmed we become when we walk down a grocery store aisle and face a floor-to-ceiling display of toothpaste with each option offering slightly different flavors and features. The way he describes it is, quote, there are 25 different brands of toothpaste. I stand in front of the display for a few moments, feeling a rising sense of panic. I know that if I choose the wrong one, my teeth will rot, my breath will smell bad, and my chances of winning friends and influencing people will be ruined. And if I pick the right one, I will have to live with the knowledge that I could have made a better choice. Schwartz is describing choice paralysis. My students were overwhelmed and they froze up because I'd created a floor-to-ceiling toothpaste aisle of options for our genius hour. With choice paralysis, the more options available, the harder it becomes to select one out of a fear of making the wrong decision. This can lead to indecision, stress, and in this case, avoidance. Now, choice paralysis is closely related to cognitive overload because both of them involve the mental effort required to make a decision. In one case, students don't know what to do or where to start. That's cognitive overload. But in this case, they know where to start, but they simply can't decide which route they want to choose. In both cases, though, the brain has to process all of this information, increasing extraneous cognitive load, and students get overwhelmed. They have a hard time evaluating all the options, and they hit choice paralysis. All right, so how do we fix it? The best independent projects use this combination of loose and tight. The loose areas are the spaces of autonomy, where students have a greater sense of ownership in the learning process. They might get to choose the topics that they will pursue or the skills that they're going to learn, but they get to do so in a way where there's some tight parameters as well. So what's happening is you've got these loose areas. Again, it could be their grouping, right? Do we do individual, partner, small group? It could be the topics. It might be like the end thing, you get to do a podcast, a video, or a website. You get the idea. But what's happening, and I've talked about this before, if you're a longtime listener at all, you've heard me talk about, the goal here is increased student agency. So we have this continuum that's teacher-centered on one side, on the far left side, that's compliance. I'm doing it because I have to. And then engagement, I'm doing it because I want to, right? That's in the middle, but it's still directed by the teacher. And then we have empowerment. It's fully student-centered. I'm doing this out of a sense of ownership. I have a sense of control in what I'm doing. Now, this sense of empowerment is great, but if students are empowered in every element of what they're doing, they will get overwhelmed. Overwhelmed by the cognitive overload and overwhelmed by the choice. So that's the loose. Now we have to create some tights. The tight elements are what you control. So students might do a genius hour, but they still have this tight of producing a blog, a series, a podcast, something like that that's limited options. they might be limited to learning a new skill rather than exploring a conceptual topic. So you're gonna do how-to videos and you have to learn a skill. You can't go learn about ancient Egypt. You might limit the scope to your subject area. It has to be related to science, for example. And throughout the project, students have predefined phases and use specific protocols that you provide. Again, those are the tights. And these tighter elements can reduce the choice paralysis while students still have a sense of ownership in their learning. But I'd also argue there's another benefit to these tights. When used effectively, these tight elements lead to creative constraint, and students are forced to think divergently. They have to maneuver around some of the more tight elements to figure out what they're going to do. Another option that you might do is to not just do loose and tights, but to take a gradual release of responsibility element where you slowly over time, over each iteration, give students more and more freedom in what they're doing. So more agency, more autonomy, more choice, more freedom as they practice Genius Hour and they get a sense of where they're going, how it's gone in the last time, less cognitive load when you do a new one because you're used to it. And now here's a little more freedom. So that's the idea of moving out of choice paralysis and managing the number of choices that students need to make. Finally, though, I want to say this. It's a journey. Ultimately, there's no single way to run Genius Hour projects. Strategies that work for you might not work for that teacher down the hall. Something that worked for you last year might not work this year. Sometimes it can help to think of each Genius Hour project as an experiment, both for you and for your students. And the key thing is that the experiment yielded learning. It's not that the experiment led to a perfect outcome, right? You're not aiming for perfection. Instead, the key idea is that you learn something new along the way. And ultimately, that makes you a more innovative teacher. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you consider leaving a review on wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon. Also, tell a friend about this. Word of mouth is one of the best ways to spread the word. And then also, again, not only leaving a review, but make sure to subscribe to it so that it shows up on your feed each week when I do a new episode. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.